Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a program about science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm your host, Cheryl Croucher. On this evening's program, a trip to Paraguay. When it comes to saving a patch of rainforest in Paraguay, scientist Samantha Song has discovered that first you must replant the trees and fight poverty. And Deb Henry is up to her elbows in chips. Technology she's helped to perfect tells pulp mills when their wood chips both look and smell just right. And historian Sandy Gao has some more stories about creative tinkerers from the early days of Alberta's search for oil. All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. When a conservation group from Paraguay asked the Alberta Research Council for help, the ARC's forest ecologist jumped at the chance to rescue a small reserve of Atlantic rainforest there. The reserve is the last remaining habitat for Paraguay's national bird, the bellbird. The future of the reserve itself is threatened due to the encroachment of farming and illegal logging. However, on their first trip to Paraguay, Dr. Samantha Song and her fellow scientists quickly realized the underlying problem there is poverty. And the success of their mission in Paraguay demands a whole new approach to forest science.
Well, we found this very interesting project down there that we're really excited about, in that there's a non-governmental organization that's been working down there for about 10 years called the Fundación Moses Bertoni. And they have purchased Interior Atlantic Rainforest Reserve, and it's called Embaracayu, and it's one of the last vestiges of this type of rainforest. And they're very interested in managing it. They've been managing it for about 10 years. But they're also doing something very innovative, which is managing the area adjacent to the reserve, sort of a different thing than we do in Canada. We concentrate on managing parks, but we don't think so much adjacent to parks. And the reason that they're doing that is because they realize that if they don't manage for the poverty and the pressures that the people are under, that those people will eventually encroach on the reserve. And so they're working quite hard on poverty alleviation and restoration of the area around the park. And so they've been looking internationally and have worked internationally with a range of organizations for help on that and looking for expertise. And so they've turned to us for help on restoration and forestry expertise and ecological expertise with that. And so we are embarking on the project to try and do that with the Canadian International Development Agency. We're looking for some financial help from them, and hopefully we'll be embarking on this in the next year.
How large an area is this reserve?
The reserve itself is about 64,400 hectares, I believe, and the buffer zone around it is about 215,000 hectares. It's basically the watershed. It's a loosely designed boundary, but the mandate for the boundary and the mandate for the reserve, that being the reserve being protection, and the buffer being sustainable development, is enshrined in law in Paraguay. So there is quite a strong mandate to develop that.
You've recently been down there to scope out the mission. What did you find?
Well, at first a surprise, because it was different for us in the sense that when you go down and we're expecting to be asked for help for forestry management, and we understood it was going to be a working forest environment, and so we were thinking in Canada you have the park, which is for recreation, and it's pretty natural state. Well, some of our parks, and the working forest, I mean, you expect some cleared areas, some regenerating areas, some intact areas. And we didn't find that at all, and we found out that most of the area had been deforested, so that we were looking at pretty much putting the forest back before you could manage it, and managing in a different way. So much more restoration management, and much more not thinking so much about the ecology, but understanding that if you don't deal with the problems that the local people have, that the reasons why they're cutting down the forest, because a lot of the deforestation in that area was due to slash and burn and was a response to intense poverty, in that the only alternative people had was to cut down the forest and sell it. and that people were quite dispossessed, and so that there was no feeling of stewardship or ownership of the land, so that things like illegal logging can happen because no one's standing in the way to stand up and say, hey, don't do that, and that you have to develop that sense of stewardship, that sense of ownership of the land, that ability to get products from the land that you can, you know, feed your family and then go on to sell in a broader market, get some money. You're not going to have any sort of stewardship or any sort of protection for the forest when someone's got an empty belly.
Who are the people who live down there around that forest?
There's a number of groups there, and this is a whole new scenario for us really understanding as forest ecologists and foresters to start really understanding socioeconomic issues there. There's indigenous peoples living there. There's peasant farmer communities, the campesinos, and then there's private landowners. And with the indigenous people, they only make up about 10% of the population. There's the Aceh people, who are a nomadic hunting population. They're very much like, they remind me of the Yanomami in Brazil. It was a very isolated population. There are apparently some people who have not been contacted, don't have contact with the outside world effectively, and they would mainly subsistence hunt. They also do some craft and artisanal products, and get most of their subsistence from hunting. There's also the Guarani people, which were an indigenous people as well, but more agriculturally based. And then the campesinos made up about 60% of that population, and these were mostly Paraguayan people who have moved into the area as an to see the opportunity of new land and a potential to either get some sort of revenue either from deforesting or now more and more and more trying to raise crops or other products. And then also there's the cattle ranchers, the private ranchers, who are the remaining population. And some of the people, those other groups, especially the campesinos, will go and work on those farms as well.
How are the farms set up? It sounds as though they're encroaching upon the forest reserve and the buffer around it.
I'm finding it difficult to understand. I asked this question of many people down there and got different answers. So I think if you interview me in a year, you'll get a different answer. But this is as I understand it now, is that people usually don't have money to buy the land, but they do get rights to the land, and those rights can be traded effectively. So there is a tenure system of sorts there. And the rights are usually given in terms of 10-hectare bundles of land by the government. And they're oriented with the parcels are 100 meters wide along the road usually, so you get access to the road, and then they stretch back for a kilometer. And then people will begin deforesting back that land along along the longer width of the forest, and start planting crops there or selling off that wood. But you do end up, they don't usually cut all the way back to the end, so there are sort of degraded patches of forest that are left across the landscape, and something for us to think about is how we can work with those degraded patches to provide some sort of connectivity of these patches to the greater reserve area.
What are some specific things that can be done or that you can help with in order to change that cycle of poverty so that they're not so dependent on going in and taking stuff out of the forest in order to survive?
I think facilitating what the Fundación has begun is the best place to start. When the people move into the area, they don't have a lot of knowledge and they don't have a lot of ability on maintaining crops, and they just don't have access to the crops. There is a credit system for crops from the government of Paraguay, but it's for cotton, and you can't eat cotton, and the market is controlled by the government, so that doesn't break that cycle of poverty. What the Fundación works at is training and providing crops that they can grow, or teaching how to raise chickens or pigs, or just basic, like local gardens, just sort of basic things that people can do, or fruit trees, and that they can feed themselves, but also there's that expectation that they give something back to the Fundación that they can then give to another community. So there's never that expectation that they're getting something for free. It's all worked. And so those are wonderful areas that they've started that I would like to see facilitating that process, because they are working with a number of communities, but they're not working with a lot of communities, and it's not very coordinated at this time. It's very reactive. I don't want to say piecemeal, but the situation is so desperate that you're often left in a reactive method, because you're like, okay, the situation has arisen where these people have moved in, or these people have lost their land, or this owner has deforested a bunch of land, so that you have to react that way. And so we're hoping we can get in, and I'm speaking to you now as someone who's been down there for, 1 week and done an intensive tour, and so I want to speak to you again in a sense when I've seen everything that's happening down there. But I can see that we're going to be in a position to sort of synthesize everything that's happening down there and try to make a more proactive type of plan for how activities are coordinated.
You've really got your work cut out for you. And before you ever get to the trees, you have all these people issues to deal with.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I think we're lucky that we have great partner organizations down there that have done a lot of the groundwork, and I think CETA and ourselves would be a lot more hesitant in going down there if we didn't have the Fundación Moses Bertoni already laying that groundwork. And so it's a beautiful area for us to try and start developing expertise at the Alberta Research Council in international development and these types of issues, because of that groundwork is there.
What will you, as a scientist from the Alberta Research Council, be doing there once you get to the tree part of things?
The first thing that we want to do is to help develop a plan for the area, and we have two approaches that, in terms of that, we want to collect ecological information about the area, what are the land use areas, what are people doing with the land, how much is left in degraded forest or intact forest, what are people using the land for. And it's something you think of, you don't think of, that you go down and people say, well, can I see a map of the area? And you'll get a very general rough map, like a topographical map or something like that, but there's been no detailed maps of the area that you could pull that kind of ecological information off. And so we want to do an ecological survey of the area, but also to work on the socioeconomic projects. And I have a wonderful sociologist working with me who's very familiar with these participatory techniques of working with local communities, and to ask people what they need, how they use the land, what's important to them. And they're really neat techniques. As a scientist who's new to them, I love them because they're what they call transformative in the process of mapping the values of the community or whatever process you use. People start to really see the roles of each other and the capacity and what they have in the community that they might not have realized, how much knowledge they do have to contribute. So it's, I don't want to call it a self-esteem building thing, but it is amazing when you end up looking around and saying, hey, we have a lot here.
Sounds like a wonderful project. Good luck.
Thank you so much, and thank you for taking an interest in it. I really appreciate it.
That was Dr. Samantha Song, a forest ecologist and senior scientist with the Alberta Research Council. Coming up, the online wood chip analyzer. When Deb Henry logs onto her computer at the Alberta Research Council, she's really tuning in as Big Brother. From her desk, she can check up on a number of pulp and paper mills around the province. What she's really interested in are the wood chips going down the conveyor belts. These are logs chipped for processing into pulp for making paper. Cameras and other sensors analyze the color and the smell of chips going into the mills.
There's several problems. And it depends on which mill you go to. The problem at Slave Lake Pulp is that they would like to put brighter chips in to make their brighter grades of paper and hopefully save chemicals by sorting their chips. So they want to be able to take the darker chips and divert them to another pile to use when they're making a lower grade of paper.
Now, how can you actually analyze that?
If you take a look with your naked eye, you can see that the chips change in color. So we thought, why not put a camera up there and then analyze the pictures coming off of the camera, and we can determine when their chips are bright and when they're dark, and take a gate and at the end of the conveyor and just sort the chips that way.
What exactly is the camera picking up on?
The camera's picking up much the same as your TV camera does, a red, green, blue signal. And we look at the red, green, blue signal and use that to determine the brightness of the chips.
Now, we're sitting in front of your computer screen here in Edmonton, and what you've got up here is a picture of the chips flowing by on the Slave Lake Mill. How is this all set up?
Well, we went up and set a camera up above the conveyor, and then we put a computer inside one of the buildings and attached them all together, and then the video camera takes a picture every so many seconds, and we analyze that picture to see if the chips are getting brighter or darker.
Looking at the computer screen, can you explain to me what all these different numbers mean?
This is the intensity of your red signal. The second number is the intensity of your green signal. And the third number is the intensity of your blue signal. So we're able to take these numbers, their averages over the whole picture, and as the numbers go up, the chips are brighter. As the numbers drop down, the chips are lower. So you set a point where you say, okay, this is where we feel the chips are too dark for the bright pile, and we send them off a different direction.
What makes some chips brighter and some darker?
You may have noticed when you cut down a poplar tree that there's rot sometimes in the middle of it. That rot usually is on the butt end of a log. So as it goes through the chipper, the top part of the tree will have nice bright white chips. But as it gets into the portion of the tree that has rot in it, there's much darker chips caused by the rot inside the tree.
So then the chips that are too dark and then they're channeled out, what happens to them afterwards?
Those chips are blended back in when they're making a grade of pulp that is of a lower brightness.
What were some of the challenges you had to overcome in order to get all of this set up and working properly?
Well, one of the things was we weren't sure how we were going to analyze the picture. It's one thing to take a picture, it's a whole other thing to have to analyze and check to see how bright the chips are. So we had to fool around with how we were going to look at the data we were getting back. The other thing is that occasionally we get a black belt when there's no chips on the belt, and we had to figure out how to deal with that and get that out of the data. And the other thing is we're taking a picture, and then farther along in the process they're diverting the chips, so we had to determine how long it took to divert it, how quickly the gate could be moved, and that type of thing. They're engineering problems more than the scientific problems have been sorted out, and the engineering problems are being sorted out as we speak.
Well, you're doing some other stuff with analyzing too. You're not just looking at the pictures of the bark and sending it off, but you're also sniffing things now. How can you sit here and sniff the chips that are going through the other mills?
Well, we have a small GC set up.
What does GC stand for?
It stands for gas chromatograph. And it takes a sample from above the first steaming bin. When chips come into a paper mill, they go into a big bin and they're heated up with steam. And you probably know from smelling pine and spruce that they smell quite differently. And we thought, well, why can't we use that to determine how much pine and how much spruce is going into a mill? So what we do is we take a sample from above this bin and we put it through a GC, and it gives us a trace of the terpenes that are coming out of the chips. And each species has its own unique signature, and we can use that to determine whether there is spruce or pine going into the mill.
What difference does that make to the mill?
Well, pine is generally more difficult to refine. It takes more energy. And pine also, it tends to have more resins in it. So that causes sometimes can cause fouling problems later on in the process with higher pitch.
So does this show up on your computer as well?
Yes, it does. I'll show you this.
So who are we connected to now?
We're connected with the Alberta Newsprint Company, and we're controlling the gas chromatograph from the computer here.
Do you see this going to other mills or having applications elsewhere?
Oh, yes. Mills are very interested in what's coming in to their mill. It helps them optimize their process. It gives them a heads up that something different is coming through, and they're going to have to adjust their parameters on how they're running. It could also have some bearing on how much chemical they use in the mill, because they will know how much to adjust their chemical usage. Now, when they see the energy going up, they assume that they're getting a different species mix, but they don't know how much it is or how long it's going to be. And with this, they'll know ahead of time that, okay, we're going to get a few minutes or several hours of a higher of one species or another.
Well, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Deb Henry is a senior research technologist at the Alberta Research Council. Next, a step back in time to the early days of oil field exploration in Alberta. Most of the early technology used to explore for oil in Alberta was imported from the United States. But it was changed and adapted by men in the field to suit Alberta's conditions. According to historian Dr. Sandy Gao, by the 1960s, Alberta's creative tinkerers were ready to take on the Americans.
The thing about these Canadian roughnecks and drillers is that essentially they're farm boys, most of them. And in the 20s and in the 30s, when they came off of farms, the most complicated piece of machinery you probably had on the farm before gas-driven tractors was the knotter on your binder. Mechanics were very simple, and then along came the tractors and other gas-driven things, and all these farm boys had to learn how to work with them. And farmers are very creative at solving problems, because they don't always have the money to go buy something new, and so they'll attempt to tinker with what they've got and make it better. And they know they don't often know that always know the scientific principle behind what they're doing, but they always seem to know how to make it work better. And that's what begins to happen with this. When you get an engine that doesn't work, you find ways of making it work better. And I have one picture I'm going to be using in the book, which is very good, that was donated by somebody here in Edmonton, and Mr. Ernie Masner of Regent Drilling. One of their rigs that had been built in 1937 was drilling in a place. It was just a small rig. And the mud pump that they needed to put mud down the hole to circulate and bring all the chips up and keep the bit cool and all that sort of thing, it burnt out. And so they couldn't continue to drill. So what they did was they went to the nearest farmer, they got his tractor, they hooked up a belt that they would use on a thrashing machine, and they drilled a hole with that. Now, that isn't exactly by the book, but who cares? They hit oil.
Do you have any other examples of very successful tinkering?
The tinkerers who sort of float to the top and form their own companies eventually, usually tend to get their start working for a company which designs and manufactures equipment in the United States. Then this equipment moves northward. They are hired to work with it or to sell it or to maintain it, and they begin to see that certain things could be done better. And they want to do that themselves. And so often what they do is they wait until the patent in the United States has run out, and then the invention is fair game, and then they make an improvement on it and they patent it themselves and they put it on the market. And I think probably the greatest contribution that Canadians have made to technology in the oil business is that they have taken standard procedures and equipment, and they have modified them, sometimes almost beyond description, to make them work much better than the original model was. Because in the oil business, there were certain periods in time when there were bursts of energy and new things came on the market. And then there's long periods of time when nothing seems to change. And then there's another burst when new things come on the market, and another long period of time with no change. So in the late 1930s, there was a real burst. And then much of that equipment went almost unaltered, or with minor changes by American manufacturers, well into the 1950s and 60s. And that's just the time the Canadians are coming on the scene. And they begin to manufacture parts for rigs by themselves.
Can you give me some examples of some of the work that people have done?
Well, I think one of the very best that Albertans may recognize is the Draco Company, which until recently was owned privately and is now part of National Oil Well. A Canadian engineer by the name of Mr. Fred Feasey got his start at Barber Machinery, which was originally a Turner Valley company. And it was a company which built practically every imaginable thing that a rig would need or could repair it. And with the help of a friend, Scotty Cameron, Draco was founded and was soon manufacturing all sorts of parts for rigs. Fred Feasey was a very practical engineer, and most people who have worked with him describe him as brilliant. And it was often on a bar napkin that a number of these designs got sketched in, and then they were handed over to the company people to do. There was a Mr. Ron Sorokin who managed the Draco shop, and he did much of the work on these particular pieces of machinery. These were really creative men. They were so successful that Draco began designing rigs and service rigs that work on the wells after they've been drilled, and they pull the pumps out and that sort of thing. So that eventually they went into offshore operations in the North Sea. They were selling to Russia as well as Norway, and they were building the rigs there. They went down to Houston and they began drilling rigs there. That's sort of like taking coals to Newcastle in that particular place. And so consequently, that company was a real Canadian success story, and their rigs were almost custom designed. If they knew where you wanted to use them, they would develop them accordingly, and a great deal of thought went into the development of these rigs.
Dr. Sandy Gow is a professor of history at Concordia University College in Edmonton. He's writing a book on changes in oil drilling technology. And thanks to the Alberta Historical Resources Foundation for sponsoring this segment of Innovation Alberta. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. I welcome your comments and suggestions. And just a note that on our website, you can listen in real audio to all the past episodes of the program. That's at innovationalberta.ckua.com. Technical producer for Innovation Alberta is Scott Franchuk. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Good night.